RunAsRadio.com. You're listening to Run As Radio, the internet audio talk show for IT professionals with Richard Campbell. This is Brandon Wen announcing show number 397, SQL question and answer at SQL intersection with guests Paul Randall, Kim Tripp, and Brent Ozar. Recorded Friday, November 14th, 2014. Run As Radio is produced each week by PWOP Productions, providing professional media and podcasting services online at pwop.com. You can follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/runasradio.
Hey, it's Las Vegas, and it's Run As Radio. And here we are doing the SQL Q&A with three friends of mine, and I think of everybody in the room, actually. I'm going to skip what Paul put on the slide. That just wasn't nice.
He's talking about the people in the audience.
We've got Kim Tripp and Paul Randall and Brent Ozar and pretty much all of the SQL speakers actually here. So I'm sure this will go in interesting directions. But I'm just a mic runner here. So you guys take it away. What are we doing and how are we going to do it?
Okay, so the plan for this is that we answer your questions. But as you know, if you don't ask us any questions, we can talk for hours about just things we like to talk about.
We can go on.
So it is in your best interest to ask questions of things you're interested in. And it's really game for any of the speakers here. So we'll kind of pick who is the best to answer your question, and we'll open up the floor. We put some topics up here. These are topics that we think are the most likely, but just because it's not up there, it doesn't mean that you can't answer it or ask a question. So, in fact, we didn't put like all the new 2014 features up there.
And look, 2014 new features.
Oh, you put 2014 new features.
That's one entry. That's lovely.
Well, there we go.
Covers
that
everything.
Covers everything. So.
So you guys want to ask questions about virtualization, because that's Brent, and cluster indexes, because that's Kimberly.
No. And corruption
detection.
You've
got English query and DTS, right?
All right, so who's going to ask a question?
Easier the better.
Right, yeah. And I'm the runner.
And the starts running.
Okay, my question is, if you had an unlimited budget, would you run a highly transactional database on a virtual machine?
Great question. If I had an unlimited budget, I would probably not use virtualization just because I want to make the easiest troubleshooting possible. The less I have to get in the way, the better. So I might choose things that were extremely easy to troubleshoot. I love virtualization dearly, but ease of troubleshooting isn't one of its strengths.
Even the cost of, like, now you've got a bare metal migration, things like that. Like, there's other benefits
she said
to being
unlimited,
in a VM.
No, unlimited budget. So I'm in. I'm going to hire multiple DBAs. I'm going to go on vacation continuously and just answer things from Bermuda. I'm going to hire outsourced services to manage the questions they can't answer.
So it's not the cost of the VM itself, but rather the cost of the service around the VM that you're mitigating from an unlimited budget.
Yep. Keep it simple, stupid. That's the easiest answer I can give out there. I wouldn't install extra services. I wouldn't put SSIS or analysis services on there. Just the engine, lock it down really hard and walk away.
And it'd be untouchable.
Untouchable, yes.
Looking for hands.
We got one up front here. Now, for those of you who want to ask a question next, let's go for this side to make Richard run as much as possible.
My wife will thank you.
Does anybody have any good lockdown scripts for 2014? Security lockdown. Getting rid of anything, everything.
Oh, man. Oh, so there's a really good SQL 2008 compliance portal. If you search for SQL 2008 compliance portal, and it sounds odd to reference a 2008 guide, but it's still really good and relevant. Like, the security features haven't changed that much. It's fantastic. It's security or SQL Server compliance guide or something like that. It's like 200 pages long. I don't usually recommend white papers because we've got white paper authors in this room. Bless your hearts. You're wonderful people. This is, I think, the best white paper that's ever come out of Microsoft because it connects business terms with us database people. So I'm a really big fan of that.
But you're not talking about any additional surface area created by 2014?
No additional, yeah. If you're crazy enough to run things like file table and file stream where people can put files in the database, that's a different story. But don't enable more features than you have to.
Yeah, leave them off.
So there's not a lot of differences in security between 2008 R2 and 14?
So there's some new additional changes that are aimed at separation of duties so that the DBAs, people can do backups without being able to see the data. Those are new improvements. I just don't know of a good guide I can point you to outside of books online as to how those work.
Thank you. Shep, you look like you're going to say something at any moment. No? No, he's all good. Okay. You never know what's going to happen next. Oh, that's good.
We just bought some new hardware to support our backup.
I can see why.
Location.
You've got an unlimited budget, right?
Our consulting rates are really low.
No, she said she had an unlimited budget. You should say they're really high.
I'm serious.
Yes.
So how should I, what's the best RAID configuration for my backup and restore server?
So it usually depends on the storage vendor, wherever you bought the storage from. For example, NetApp, they have this RAID DP that's the fastest on their system. EMC has a different approach, all these. Read the SAN vendor's best practices. And if you don't have any, I would go with RAID 10. RAID 10 gives you less space, but typically I've got multiple SQL servers backing up to the same place at the same time, and RAID 10 is awesome at random writes. So, and it also ties in with the unlimited budget. Not
That's
much storage space, but hey.
Yeah, it is your best choice with the unlimited budget. I mean, you're paying more, but you're getting the striping as well as the redundancy, the mirroring. So,
and would
it's
you
a
do
great
that all SSD? Because, you know, no budget constraints?
That's exactly
no
where I was
No budget constraints,
going.
Sure.
Yeah, yeah.
Where is Fusion.io and SanDisk when we need them?
Burn hundos.
Sure.
Yes.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And there's a really good set of white papers that talk about optimizing backups to a secondary storage, having dedicated NICs and a private network, and really getting better performance, which all costs money. The company, the main guy that wrote it, worked for an online gambling company who also had unlimited budget for the most part. So they have a whole bunch of tips and tricks. And if you can't find the white paper, if you look for backup resources trip, I wrote a blog post with a whole bunch of links of backup resources, and that's a couple of really good ones to help you with the optimization there.
So with new storage technologies and new backup technologies coming out for systems administrators, how do you guys feel about products like Avamar, who are claiming can do full database backups and take SQL Server out of the equation and do point-in-time restores while the system's live?
This is not for that particular product, but generalized across all non-native SQL Server backup products. I've seen so many horror stories where somebody's been relying on non-native SQL Server backups and it's failed when a disaster's actually happened. You need to make sure that anytime you're using someone that's not SQL Server, you test it so that you can make sure your restore strategy works. Okay? Secondly, you also need to make sure that if it's a third-party system that requires you can only get to the backups when that system is up and running, I wouldn't use it because that's another extra point of failure. Kevin.
One other comment is you need to be clear on what point in time means, because unless you're plugged into SQL Server, you're not going to get really fine-grained point in time that's transactionally consistent. SQL Server does that by replaying the transaction log during a restore log, and we can stop at any point in time, literally any LSN. A system that's not plugged into SQL Server is at best going to say, we'll cut it off at this instant in time, but that's not a transactional boundary.
You know, there's a difference between a checklist and actually knowing. Like, I would really want to do some abrupt stops and restarts and see what the restore actually looks like and, you know, have some faith that I know where my transactions are actually at. The only thing that seems to actually understand transactions is SQL Server. Mm-hmm. Lots of people say they can get to a certain point, but that's just time. That's not transactional boundary.
Well, and I don't want to pick on other Microsoft products, but there have been some in the past that have claimed, certain capabilities with Small Business Server and so forth that you could get up to the minute, and they didn't support that. And so you always want to make sure that whatever they say they're doing, whatever you've set up, you've tested it. You know, that statement, you don't have a backup until you've done a restore, is really, really important. And if anything ever changes, because I had a customer once that had changed some things in their backup and just thought, oh, these are configuration options, no big deal. This is a long time ago, but they happened to hit a bug. I mean, this is literally over 10 years ago. But I'm just saying, they thought that they were totally covered because they had tested their backup strategy a while back, right? They changed a few things, and then they happened to have a problem, had to go do a restore, and they couldn't restore because of a bug that they hit that they just never expected. And I'm not saying that there's bugs. I'm just... if you don't test it, you will never find it until you really need it, and that's too late. So it's just, it's a really good idea with third-party products to make sure that they really can put their money where their mouth is and do what they claim. Because sometimes incremental doesn't mean incremental. Sometimes, you know, so I always need to know what they're actually doing behind the scenes. So it's a great question.
Yeah, I've got a question about SQL Standard Edition and high availability and disaster recovery options, especially with database mirroring heading off into the sunset.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is a good one for Kevin.
Oh, my goodness. You reached for the mic, too. Go for it. Fire away.
So was it just in general, or was there anything more specific? So we have put database mirroring on a deprecation path because it essentially fills the same niche that availability groups does using slightly different technology, and we'd really rather not maintain two code bases to do the same thing. We recognize that we can't pull the functionality out of the product until we have a direct replacement, and one of the gaps is having a replacement for at least the database mirroring functionality in standard. So we won't pull the feature out of the product until that's there. There's some other capabilities that are also holes that we're working on. So when we have all those holes plugged, so we do have a direct replacement, then you'll expect to see database mirroring actually go away.
And if you're listening on the podcast, that's not just some strange homeless guy who wandered in and got the microphone. That's Microsoft's Kevin Farley. So, yes.
Yeah, can't get a whole lot more authoritative, actually. Yes. I'm super glad you're here, sir. Thank you.
Can I read between the lines on that? That's some interesting information. I'm just saying it's interesting information. It's a great point. They won't pull it till there's a replacement. So.
That's the right thing to do. Yeah, take care of a customer.
Doesn't Microsoft always do that?
Always.
Oh, no, wait. Was the microphone on? No,
always.
Yes.
Always.
Yes.
Always. Sir.
Is there any physical limitations distance-wise on where you put the actual file share witness on AG? And if there's any performance impact or adverse effect during failover?
Do you need a file share witness for always-on availability groups? You want some kind of tiebreaker? If you want to search for a long video on this, I say long, like 30 minutes, Kendra just posted, search for Kendra Little Quorum. Or Kendra Little Cluster video, and she's got a few videos that go into detail and demo it back and forth. There's not a performance impact, though. You want this, it's a good thing. Read up on how Cluster Quorum works. It's god-awful detailed. It's kind of nasty, but you do need dynamic witnesses, starting with 2012 and 2012 R2. Has all kinds of cool quorum recalculation stuff built in that will automatically use the file share if it needs to.
What was your concern about the distance of the...
Like thousands of miles away from the site. Yeah, we're trying to put the file share witness 1,000 miles away, like maybe in UK, and we have New York and New Jersey data center. I'm just trying to see if this architecture holds true, if there's any performance impact, if this is even doable. That's the question.
Generally, I'd want it as close to the primary as I could get it.
I'm wondering if latency matters in that scenario. It's not that many bytes.
Well, and also every network failure between here and there reduces the likelihood that they're going to see each other when disaster strikes. Forget
Nothing
that.
Nothing ever goes wrong with undersea cables, Brent.
Yeah, or inside the data center. So I wouldn't put it any further away than I had to.
Yeah, I guess the question is it a performance issue or just a reliability issue? I mean, admittedly, long wires have issues. But
Yeah, I wouldn't do it just for the reliability issues.
Yeah.
I forget the performance. I just don't want my witness somewhere long, far away.
One of the things you need to consider is where, and this is one of the best practices we had for clusters, and we're actually with mirroring, is to try and figure out that if you lose network connectivity, where are your users going to be? Because if the secondary site is solely just for disaster recovery, you may not want your witness there and have it come online when all your users are near the primary. You know what I mean? So you get into a situation where if you lost network connectivity, but all of your users are in, let's say, near data center one, and the data center one connectivity will stay online, you want to make sure that that one can maintain quorum so it stays local. Because if your quorum ends up getting sent to, you know, let's say data center two, where none of your users are, and that is your DR site, your other DC1 may come offline and your users may not be able to access that. So, I mean, it's more than just a performance perspective. You may want to consider, it's like, okay, if I lose network connectivity, where is everything? What do I want to stay online if one of them goes away? So that's probably, I mean, for my mind, that's one of the most important things to think about, especially at Upper East Coast if something bad happens again.
And for people at home, that was Microsoft's Shep Shepard.
Can you talk a little bit about the cardinality estimation? And my second question is about the statistics. So what is your recommendation for, you know, stats updates on indices?
It's kind of a generic, I mean, it's there's not a lot for me to answer there. I mean, I could do a whole half hour, 45 minutes on when you would want to update, why you would want to update, the types of updates you'd want to do based on table size, based on the types of problems you might be having. But I could even say that based on table size, sometimes even updating stats might not be enough. You might need more stats, like filtered stats. There really isn't an answer to the question unless you give me a little bit more insight. But yes, I want my stats to be updated. I want them to be updated regularly. I generally want them to be updated off hours. I still leave the auto-update stats option on, but I create jobs that manage statistics so that hopefully it's not happening at 10 o'clock on a Monday morning. But if my job messes up, then at least the auto-update will kick in. Plus, there's some other funky things with auto-update not being on if you're not in 2012 and higher. I mean, this, like I said, I could go on for days on just generalized stats. Do you have an issue specifically? Like, I'm not sure what to answer.
No, I'm getting some mixed, answers when I talk to people. You know, they say, okay, as long as you turn on the auto, you know, statistics, you don't have to, you know, have any scheduled jobs or maintenance job to specifically go do that.
No, those people are lying to you.
Write down their names. Yeah.
Yes, we want to hunt them down. No, I understand the idea of letting auto update stats kick in and do its thing. But at the same time, on higher-end systems, so maybe the argument there could be on a system where there's maybe not as much going on, you don't really care about the stats getting updated that often, maybe you don't even have big problems with stats, maybe query performance isn't the most important problem there. That's hard to say. I wouldn't let auto-update be the only mechanism for updating stats, personally, just because it can be expensive to do, even if it's not... changing even the query's performance, just the updating of stats has to read data, it has to build work tables in TempDB to update the stats. So this takes resources that could clear your buffer pool, right, of the data that you're using, right, just bringing all that data into cache. So I'd rather do that off hours as opposed to 10 o'clock on a Monday morning.
So but part of your maintenance updates, cycle.
What's that?
Part of your maintenance cycle off
hours.
Yeah,
but let me take a step back. Auto update only updates a statistic when the statistic is needed. So to be honest, a statistic that's just laying around not doing anything would never get updated, and it doesn't need to be updated because nobody's using it. So auto update does have some optimizations in it that they're not updating a stat that's not being used. And I could make an argument that your maintenance routine that updates all of your stats might actually be updating a lot of stats that never get used, and there isn't a stats usage stats. That would be nice.
So where would you go to learn more? Where would you go if you want to learn about statistics? What resources would you recommend?
Well, we have a workshop that's running all day tomorrow.
There you go.
Where Joe and I are going to talk about stats and cardinal. So, I mean, I'm not trying to push that, but
you should. Friends. Yeah.
No, absolutely. I mean, we are spending the whole day. It's important to understand them. It's important that they're up to date. But that's not the only issue to be concerned with regard to stats. And so there's a couple of other things to be concerned about. And I do recommend that you update stats. I sometimes recommend that you create extra stats. But then if you do that and you're just blindly maintaining stats, you might be doing a lot more maintenance work than you would need to if you just leveraged auto update. So it's not a 5-second answer. There is a statistics white paper that tells you kind of what statistics are. It doesn't go into all the little nuances. Some of us have done blog posts. There's resources. What are you guys doing behind my back?
We're trying to imagine you ever giving a 5-second
They know that
answer.
I can talk all day, so yeah. They're thanking you for this question, all right? So is there anything specific, or is that kind of you just wanted to get some...
Yeah,
I think
to me, and then correct me if I'm wrong here, this idea of don't just trust automatic stats is the most important thing you said in that it doesn't automatically do everything all of the time. It's in your best interest to maintain your own stats as well.
Okay, so let me take a step back.
Oh, my God.
Here comes another 5 seconds.
So in SQL 2005, the mechanism for determining that your data has changed, this threshold of 20%, changed from being what's called a row modification counter to a column modification counter. The positive for that is that it solved a problem where if you had one column that was incredibly volatile and you hit this 20% threshold, I haven't even gone into how it's calculated, but let's just say 20% of your data changed, even though that's not exactly how it works. But when 20% of your data changes on that one column, essentially, because that's the only one being modified, they invalidate all of the stats on your entire table. Okay? Now, when they moved to a column modification counter, they went to 20% per column. The interesting thing is that if you didn't have the problem where one column was really volatile and instead you had a little bit in this column and a little bit in this column and a little bit in this column and a little bit in this column, then the 20% per column was actually not very high per column. Now we're waiting for 20% per column. That is the default. There is a trace flag, 2371, which can change from doing the 20% threshold to more of what's called a dynamic threshold, which after 25,000 rows drops to like 99, 98, and it gets asymptotically closer to 1% as you get into billions of rows. So you're not waiting for 20% of 1 billion rows, which is sometimes a crazy number of rows. So my point, bringing it all together, is to a certain extent, the 20% is kind of too long to wait, especially as you get to bigger tables. But I still don't want a big table at 20% at 10 o'clock on a Monday morning to kick off an auto update, which is why I really want to do it off hours. So
check out the white paper from Joe Sack about the 2014 cardinality estimator as well.
That's the CE.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Yes. By all means, it's excellent. And it helps determine.
Yeah. It's a fantastic white paper. Yeah. So that's your stats question. The CE side of things. There's the pre-2014 cardinality estimation model, and there's the 2014 cardinality estimation model. That's on by default if your compatibility mode is for 2014. If your compat mode is not for 2014, you use the legacy CE. The beauty, though, is that you have the ability to switch which CE you use, and there's some cool tricks for doing that. So I guess you have the option. The thing I love the most about 2014 is you could use the new model, you could leave the old model, and then just query-based use the new model. So there's lots of cool things about the new CE. So that's my generic CE answer. Joe, do you want to add more? I'm sorry.
That's good.
Yeah, and Joe's got a fantastic white paper on the CE for 2014. Oh, don't make me kick your...
5 seconds, she said. 5 seconds.
Hello, everybody. My name is Haseeb Ahmed. I'm from Aon Corporation. We have over 600 SQL servers running all over the globe. Thanks to Microsoft for raising the price off the chart, especially with Enterprise Edition. But there are some beautiful features, so thanks a lot for your hard work. I think my question is to show value to our higher management when it comes to different database management systems. We have Oracle, DB2, Sybase, everybody is there. It's getting hard from a SQL Server perspective for me to convince them the Enterprise Edition cost. And MySQL coming into picture, bringing a lot of value to the database management systems. I think my question is, going with a virtual private cloud within our company with Enterprise Edition host, having unlimited SQL Server guests hosted on it, might be something that interests us a lot, you know, makes us, you know, show that there is a lot of value. The question is, 600 SQL servers, 80% is physical. How do we translate that physical load into virtual? Sorry for the lengthy question, but I just wanted to give a little bit back. And thank you, everybody, all the presenters over here for the great conference.
For me, a lot of it has been just consolidation. During the SQL Server sprawl era, it was so easy to throw in the DVD when it was relatively cheap, go build and build and build. And now you should be virtualizing. You should be consolidating down. Today's processors are crazy fast. And I'll go into a shop and I'll see, you know, 4-socket servers with, you know, 6 cores each. And SQL Server's Task Manager is doing like 10%. The DBAs are clapping themselves on the back for doing such a great job. But we're wasting money. We as database administrators have to push that consolidation, virtualization. That's our job. We do have to start showing that value. And reducing a footprint is the way that you do it.
Certainly, you've got incentive to consolidate.
Yep.
You're looking for something that translates the loads from physical to virtual. So here's the problem with that, is that whenever you go deploy a new virtual server today, you're doing it on modern hardware. You don't go deploy new VMs on a, you know, 1-year-old or 2-year-old CPU. CPUs get dramatically faster every single time. You're talking about different amounts of I/O throughput, different amounts of memory. There is no one-to-one mapping, and there will never be. When I worked for Quest, ended up getting acquired by Dell, we tried building a capacity management system to do exactly that, to say if the server's this big and it's running at 40% utilization, can we show what it'll be in virtual? And we can't. You can't do it.
Well, we looked at Map Toolkit by Microsoft. Uh-huh. It's a free tool. It does give a little bit of virtual to SQL Server, physical uh-huh. to virtual. There's a VMark tool by VMware, but still there's a challenge. We cannot really depend on the results because it's just not reliable enough for us.
You'll never be able to.
Yeah, this is actually a big question, and Brent kind of nailed it, because you're essentially talking about a consolidation effort. And one of the things I talked about the other day, and I'm going to try not to go too long on this one, because I can talk for a while.
Take your
as
time.
Well. But it's a popular topic. And one of the things when I did this session on Tuesday about basically Azure and the concept behind the cost model and the operational model of Azure is the fact that we're making the assumption that not every single person that has a workload that will run at 100% is all going to show up on the same day. You know, the idea being that you've got tax season where everybody hits, 100% utilization on everything around April, and then you've got Black Friday, which is around November. Well, we could technically run that in the same cluster only because they're not going to be happening at the same time. And the idea is customers have been trying to do this for years to get virtualization to take advantage of that same concept, where you'll actually have all the people across that. But the thing is, you can still isolate, the hardware. Whereas your virtual machine will not be sharing CPU with another virtual machine, and you will not overcommit the memory. But you can still take, let's something like a DL980, an 80-core server, and run, data center on it, and take advantage of all these different pieces and isolate by NumaNode and take advantage of it. And that's the very question and the very thing that we've looked at, because I know what the average CPU utilization of an Azure data center is, and I can't say. But I expect if you look at your average CPU utilization using your tools across the board, it's fairly low. The problem is, how do you take what you have in a piece of hardware, be it a 32-core machine, a 16-core machine, or an 8-core machine, and translate that into a VM? The first problem you're going to have is, as Brent said, the processors today are newer, they are faster, they're more efficient. But what is the overhead of the software you're going to be running? We did a white paper, and Cat didn't do it, but SQL Cat actually, I think we helped sponsor the paper, to where we did a side-by-side comparison on, I think it was Windows 2012, bare bones versus Hyper-V for the exact same configuration. I think it was a terabyte of memory with 64 processors. And we came up with that maximum TPC load, it was around a 10% hit at 100% CPU. And then you could scale it down from there and back off. But the reality is, it's like everything else. You have to create a proof of concept, take a small machine, right, do a test. Because the problem is, it's not as simple as you just moving to a virtualized CPU. What is your storage? What is your network? What is your I/O path? All of it changes.
Right. And that's exactly what we are doing as a database engineer. I'm doing the POC with Azure, with Amazon EC2. I mean, they're working beautifully.
Yeah, same rules apply on-prem, though.
Yeah, the scalability is off the charts. So.
Yeah, I mean, the exact same rules apply on-prem. And this isn't just an Azure problem. This is a testing problem when you're moving from one server to another. And it's like I said the other day, just because you've bought a brand new server does not mean that it's whatever it's planning on replacing does not mean it's going to be better and faster. Everything is new, and you need to treat it like that every single time. So, and it's a hard question. So,
one other thing along those lines as well is consider Resource Governor, and consider using Resource Governor to monitor deterministically without putting any limits in place. Because then you can see at the app level, database level, what the overhead is. And now in 2014, we can look at I/O. And to Shep's point about NUMA, you can affinitize to a scheduler and at the NUMA node level starting at 2012. So Resource Governor gives you a lot of those capabilities that you could change immediately that would apply to whatever new connections are coming in once those changes that are taking place. You don't have to restart the instance. It's just an alter Resource Governor reconfigure. And those changes will immediately apply for CPU memory, NumaNode affinitization, scheduler affinitization, and I/O for 2014.
Hello. I have a question on replication, specifically peer-to-peer.
Oh, time for me to go.
I just want to know if this is the only way to do master-master, or eventually in the future, always-on is going to be able to do master-master in order to be able to write at the same time in two different locations.
Oh, boy. I'm gonna be. Can I use a web browser? All right. Well, I mean, that's not an opinion question either. No, I probably can't use a web. So what I'm going to pull up is a blog post by Jeremiah Peschka. The question was, what happens if you wanted to know what you should do in the future for multi-master replication?
Well, two questions. Peer-to-peer, is anybody investing? I mean, is anybody working to improve it? Microsoft, I mean. And is always-on going to take over and it's going to be able to support multiple sites to write right at the same time?
But that's apples and oranges. You can't compare replication to always-on as a replacement for replication because replication allows you granularity of having smaller subset. It allows you taking some data from here, some data from here, some data from three different servers for those of you on the podcast, and bringing them to one server. You can do part of a database. You can put different indexes on the subscriber. You can put RCSI on the subscriber, but not on the publisher. Huge amounts of flexibility with replication and the ability to trickle over just the changes to just the replicated data continuously. Huge benefits. If what you're trying to do is take the entire database and every row and you want an exact replica, replication isn't your choice. Don't use replication for that. That's not really the primary reason. If you want an exact replica with changes to be sent over, you've got AGs, you've got database mirroring. Those are the correct solution if something is literally just for HA or HA and reporting without adding extra indexes and so forth. Yes, we can have statistics on a secondary now with AG, but you can't put different indexes on there. You can't have part of the database sent over. That's the beauty of replication. Replication isn't going away per se. It's totally different. If what you're trying to do is HA, then you go AGs. I mean, unless you're not Enterprise Edition, your standard, then you go mirroring. But that is all of the changes, the entire database, quote unquote, mirrored to that secondary. Do you see what I'm saying? So they're not, it's like comparing apples and oranges. They both have merit. Some of us like one better than the other, but it depends.
Yes, it's true. Our main reason to use it is that we use two different sites, two different continents. Let's say people from one continent log in there, but in case the data center goes down, we would like to be able to forward them to the other data center.
So there are a lot of tricks you can do inside the database to pull this off, but if you want two writable copies of the same database, life is going to be hard. This is where Jeremiah's blog post comes in for the folks on the web podcast. Search for Many Masters, One Truth and SQL Server Replication. If you seriously want two writable copies of a database inside this in two different data centers, I'm going to get shot for saying this, but now is the time where you want to think about something other than SQL Server. If that's truly a business requirement for you, that's not an easy place to be with SQL Server. What I'd push for instead is try to figure out how you can make your network connectivity more reliable, and if you can't make it reliable between the sites, this is where Azure is awesome. Microsoft will give you a much more reliable SQL Server than you may be able to build in-house. That way, everybody can connect to it even when one of your data centers implodes.
Okay, thank you.
You bet. I didn't get shot yet.
Just wait,
I said
Brent.
The Azure. I said the A word, right? As long as I pimp Azure in there, we're all good. Oh, he's waving around. So for those of you who can't tell, Paul Randall is expressing his love for the cloud and interpretive dance.
Okay, say we have server, we host about 100 databases. In general, is it good practice to mirror every single database or put every single database to each group?
What version of SQL Server are you running?
It's just a general question.
So
if we say mirroring, it's 2008 R2, AG, it's 2014.
Uh-huh. So what version of SQL Server you have depends on whether or not you can use always on, because it's only 2012 and newer. Here I go getting about to get shot again. I would only use it these days in 2014 and newer. It's awesome. It's incredible in 2014. Mirroring was pretty good in 2012 and even earlier. If you can get by with that and you're on the older version of SQL Server, keep using it. It's fine. It's both of the features are just different. I wouldn't make version decisions based on which technology you wanted to use.
So a lot of it has to do with what, if you look at the additional features, I think of availability groups as a superset of mirroring, because it has the core functionality of mirroring plus a bunch of extra functionality. You can have up to the instant readable secondaries rather than doing standby to get access to your secondaries, as in log shipping. So you have a lot more capabilities that aren't in database mirroring. If you don't need those, then there's no reason to move. And of course, availability groups today is an enterprise license, which is more money, which is always a consideration. If you're running enterprise anyway, I'd run AGs because you've got more flexibility.
There's also things like clustering. It adds the dependency on clustering. If you're not good at clustering, don't go to always-on availability groups.
Okay, I guess my real question is, are there any limit for like the number of database per server to mirror or to add to AG group, or there's no limit?
So there's a supported limit, which is, I believe, 50 databases on a server.
2012, I think it's 100. 101 replica or two replicas was the test case or something like that.
Those are the limits that we have tested to. I know of instances where customers have had an order of magnitude more databases.
That's for AGs though, right?
For AGs.
Right.
Database mirroring hasn't been... We haven't put the work into database mirroring to make it scale better because we're putting that effort into availability groups. And again, Bob Ward will tell you the limit is 100 databases. Reality, it'll probably work farther.
Yeah, Stack Overflow, we've got like 400 or 500 databases per availability group, and it works fine.
So this might be a selfish job security question, but what do you see, any of you, as the biggest threats to SQL Server? Whether it's other products, new
ideas,
so
good.
Trends.
Oh, that's great. Oh, how can you not want to answer that? Oh, this is fantastic. What's the greatest threat to SQL Server DBAs? So for a while there, like maybe 5 or 10 years ago, it was, it's going to be self-tuning, and you just install it, and it's amazing. And, you know, that's never come true. It's not going to come true because we keep getting new features that push the boundaries of, you don't even get monitoring software to tell you what's going on in these brand new features. So I'm actually really excited by the investments Microsoft's continue to make in the Box product. But what you need to do is listen to what developers are doing, watch and see what technologies they choose to use in their new products. This is why I'm so excited about what Microsoft's doing around the open source space and around the Azure space, that they are continuing to welcome developers into the SQL Server ecosystem. So I hate to, you know, jinx myself, but I kind of want to knock on wood. I don't think that that's a problem for SQL Server DBAs for the future. There's also no school for DBAs. It's not like it's getting easier to become a DBA. So even if something else really cool turned up tomorrow, like if everybody went to Azure en masse, we've still got jobs for life managing all the old stuff that's out there, just like mainframe guys had jobs for a really long time. I'm not saying I would encourage people who are brand new to the field to only do SQL Server and nothing but SQL Server. You should always keep your ear to the ground and see what else cool is coming out there.
Isn't there a larger job here as well, Brent, that goes just beyond a given product into responsibility for data in an organization?
I think that database professionals have an obligation to hear what's out there and know what's not right to put in SQL Server, what's right to put somewhere else. Stack Overflow is a great example. We move full text search off to other platforms instead. Not because SQL Server can't do it, but there was just a better, cheaper alternative in that space. Whereas the core Q&A is still in SQL Server. It's an amazing product. But being able to give that architectural guidance to your end users and customers is awesome.
And throwing my dev hat on, because sometimes I'm the .NET Rocks guy too, you know, from a developer perspective, there was a bunch of reasons to start experimenting with other data stores. One of them was that we had a certain number of difficult DBAs and we could bypass them. But another one of them was, we were sticking stuff in your database that really shouldn't be there.
I still have the scars.
We're starting to see development models now where you see the roles of different data stores inside of a given application. It's not all one data store anymore.
And it's cheaper and easier to stand up those other data stores now, too. The barrier of entry keeps dropping.
I also feel like they're getting to know those ones better and find out what they're not good at and miss SQL Server in some cases.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, there's stuff that SQL Server is stunningly good at, and we've forgotten that it's actually good at those things because we've always had it around. Mm-hmm. You know, it's been a long time since I've had to discuss with developers what ACID was all about. But when NoSQL really jumped up and they're going, this is so much faster, why do we ever use SQL Server? It's like, do you remember when we couldn't actually store data? Oh, you couldn't? Because you weren't born. Okay, you know, now let's have that conversation about this is what it means to have a reliable data store.
If you have the hear the siren song of some alternate data platform, Google for Call Me Maybe and the name of the database platform, which it's not going to produce music videos. There's actually like Call Me Maybe Elasticsearch, Call Me Maybe Redis. And there's this guy who makes a living out of breaking database platforms. And he posts these epic long posts about all the ways that they fail. It's so cool to read those and go, wow, that's a smoking mess. You know, I have so many cool, you know, SQL Server bugs, so they have nowhere near that bad. You know, so it really helps developers understand the strengths and weaknesses of these other platforms.
That's a great one.
And what would be your recommendation on storing files into SQL Server? You have FileStream now. You can put it on your file system, do a reference to it, or you can do it in the table. And with regulations now on secondary market and everything, we have to save large appraisals into our systems to keep reference to them to be able to give them to the customer. So what would be your recommendation on like 2 megabyte files, 4 megabyte files that are larger in size than just your kilobytes?
To be honest, for files that are that small, I would just store them as varchar max. I wouldn't bother going the route of doing them with FileStream because it's an extra level of complication. It's also the design point for FileStream is where you're wanting very large files and you want very fast streaming access to them. For what you've described, that's not your use case. The other problem with FileStream is it really complicates your backup and restore strategy. Yeah, the more files you've got out there in your FileStream store, the longer it's going to take to do your restore, which can really screw up your downtime service level agreements. So again, I mean, looking at what your requirements are, and then picking the feature that's going to meet those requirements. And in your case, it's not FileStream.
If it's data you're never going to edit, if you're only inserting only, storage vendors have amazing devices that just take writes and never allow you to modify them. I really like those a lot because it gets it out of my wheelhouse and makes it somebody else's problem.
It's lovely now, for audit, too.
Yeah.
Just, you know, as a guy who's gone through a bunch of that on the financial regulation side where we're writing, you know, end-of-month transactional boundaries or end-of-day transactionals, and you can't be altered. So when the auditor comes through and goes, you put it where? We put it there once, and that's it. Uh-huh. And it happens to be lovely and fast, too. Uh-huh. It just shortened up, like, I'm guessing your healthcare or financial, you know, but healthcare would have the same thing. Most of the stuff has never changed, right? Uh-huh. It's all journal. So putting it in write-only stores rocks. Uh-huh. Like, it's just a nice way to live, and it cuts down a lot of cycles and a lot of things. Uh-huh.
Yeah, from a performance perspective, there was a really good white paper called To Blob or Not to Blob by Jim Gray, and Paul references it in his FileStream white paper. And even if you end up not wanting to use FileStream, if you're going to put millions of files in a subdirectory, you're going to need to optimize for doing that. And so Paul talks about how to do that for FileStream, which would translate, obviously, for putting it in the file system as well. So that would be the good white paper to start with. He's got a whole set of categories on FileStream, and he references Jim Gray's white paper, but I wanted to at least mention that, To Blob or Not to Blob, Jim Gray, and then Paul Randall for FileStream. So a couple of good white papers. And there's a lot of debate on this. I mean, I am not a fan of putting really large static read-only objects into a database for a variety of reasons. I think you're crazy to do that to a certain extent, but if you have a lot of change, then something like FileStream, which can get you up to the minute recovery, is great. But it really, there's so many facets there that you want to look at. There isn't kind of a simple size related answer to it. I think it's more of a usage related answer. But Jim Gray does talk about speed for certain sizes and which one should be and shouldn't in the database because of size. So that's interesting, but I think there's more to it. And maybe Kevin does
She
too.
Won't give up the mic that easy, I tell you.
And I got to say, my heart still aches when I see his name.
One other option that's kind of going off on a different tangent is that there's a feature pack called RBS Remote Blob Store, and it's a client-side library that's designed to plug into content addressable stores, which are these write-only stores. And essentially, it's not rocket science. It's just encapsulating the logic to track the references to your blob store objects in your database. So your database row has a reference to it. There's a library that understands each store, that understands the translation between its native key mechanism and what gets stored in your database, and it's just keeping those two in sync. So it's not having to write that code. It's essentially what you're buying, but you get your blobs stored in a store that is custom made for that kind of thing, and then the database shrinks to a more manageable size.
Just on top of her question, is Microsoft's roadmap to store blobs or basically any documents go file stream, or are you guys going to be supporting JSON pretty soon on future release?
Go ahead, you can go on record. Just to put out the roadmap out there.
I like my job. I can't comment on future features that haven't been released yet.
We can't ask Microsoft people to do that, but we could probably ask other people to speculate.
There's also, in the Azure space, there's DocDB, which is kind of a NoSQL store aimed at documents.
So a long time ago, we got all excited because we started having the ability to store XML in the database. Woohoo! Put all the XML in the database! And then we learned really quickly that shredding XML on the SQL Server, probably not the best use of our $7,000 a core CPU cycles, right? Like, I don't want to make the SQL Server an app server. So if I did put JSON data in the SQL Server, I want to ask some tough questions about where any processing would happen. I'd want to hit the brakes before people say, oh, let's do all kinds of document processing inside the SQL Server. Just make sure you're doing the right processing in the right place. So if that, just saying, if that feature would get announced, make sure you use it the right way, just like we had challenges with XML. Is that a technical problem? It's a financial problem. At $7,000 a core, Enterprise Edition is expensive. No playing around. App servers are free/cheap. You know, I'd rather do any CPU, like shredding of strings, looking for specific values. Don't do that in SQL Server.
The last CPU you want to use is the one with an Enterprise SQL license on it.
Yes.
Do all that stuff somewhere else.
Yes.
What role would batch requests play in determining if six-pack awaits are a problem?
I wouldn't really see them as related.
So there would be correlation between batch requests and the overall wait time?
So is there a correlation between batch requests and waits? Sure. The more work you ask SQL Server to do, the more it's going to have to wait. But just because I see low or high batch requests a second doesn't necessarily mean that I have a CX packet problem or a parallelism problem.
So if you're troubleshooting CX packets, then batch requests really wouldn't play into your determining or troubleshooting CX packets at all?
No, I wouldn't look there. Paul White had great sessions yesterday. I had one earlier. And we talked through how to look for the queries that are doing the most work by analyzing the plan cache. That's where I'd start rather than looking at the number of queries that are happening. Because you can get CX packet problems with one ugly query. You can have one ugly guy saying, scan all the data and join all the tables. And just one batch request a second can kill you.
And I'll add as well that just because you've got CX packet waits happening in your system doesn't mean you've got a problem. That just means you're running stuff in parallel. Okay, you've got to determine what's running in parallel, and would you expect it to be running in parallel, or do you want it to be running in parallel? And then for those things that are running in parallel, if you want to see whether the CX packet waits are actually a problem, I'd be looking at sys.dmos waiting tasks and seeing if you're seeing any threads apart from thread ID 0 showing a CX packet wait. Because the coordinator thread in any parallel operation is always going to register a CX packet wait, and that's just normal parallelism. It's when any of the other threads as well are also doing CX packet waits, you've got some kind of skewed work distribution amongst the threads, that's where you've got problematic parallelism. Okay, so there's two things you want to look at. The parallelism that's there, do you want it? And then the parallelism that's there, if you do want it, is it going properly?
That's where the thread is not zero?
Yeah, so the coordinator thread, if you look at DMOS waiting tasks, you'll see the exact context ID, and that is the thread ID. Okay? Thread ID 0 always is the coordinator thread in a parallel operation. Any other thread ID that you see apart from 0, if it's showing CX packet weight, then you've got some kind of skewed work distribution across the parallel threads in your operation.
That's a great tip, Paul. That's a good thing to know. I think we've got time for one more question. Any hands?
For those of you who are reading on the podcast.
If Kim's not answering it, then we have time for two more questions.
just a quick one. What's some of the worst SQL Server advice you've heard on the internet?
If you see CX packet weight, set max GOP to 1.
Yeah, that's pretty bad.
If your PLE is 300 or above, you don't have a problem. Yeah. Just run auto shrink.
Yeah.
So the first two are probably the worst I've ever seen. And that's CX packet weights. If you're seeing CX packet weights and you set max GOP to 1, that's the worst sledgehammer knee-jerk reaction you could possibly do. Because you're turning off one of the two go faster switches that SQL Server has, which is parallelism and non-clustered indexes, I would say.
I want our mic back.
Go ahead.
I was also going to say, like, put an index on every column is a really common, horribly bad thing to do. Is there a certain...
If you have a cluster, don't bother taking backups anymore.
Oh, my God.
Same deal.
Oh, myths and misconceptions. God, there's so many. Paul did a series. I was actually going to say, for those of you that are interested in weight stats, one of the things you can search on is Paul Randall, tell me where it hurts. That just sounds so horrible to say on this webcast. But he did a series of posts on weight statistics and actually has queries on the kind of tell me where it hurts series that will help you to start analyzing for these things called weight stats. And depending on the weight stats, he actually has a tremendous amount of information on where people's weight stats are and then how to start analyzing some of those weight stats and further queries to go a little bit deeper. And there's some good information. And this is, I get that question a lot, like, my server's slow, what should I do? Now, I don't know what the fix is, but what you need to start with is figuring out where your server is slow. Like, why is it waiting? Where are the things that it's doing the most and the most expensive operations? And it's always a great place to start weight stats. And then depending on what the weight stats are, then you start to drill in and you can find out why you have CX packet problems. And it's probably not users, it's probably what the users are doing. And that's where you start looking at queries and so forth. So this is always a great place to start.
All right, I think that's all the time we've got. Let's have a big hand for our panel. And this epic front row of amazing people. Thank you so much for being a part of Runaz Radio and a part of SQL Intersection. We hope to see you all in the spring. And we'll talk to you next week on Runaz Radio.